I'm doing fine. I'm in a parking lot at Wesleyan University in my car, and we're gonna do an all Tiger Woods edition from here. But because I'm in the parking lot, I'm here because I'm doing the college tour with my daughter, who's a senior in high school. But that means I have not seen the Tiger Woods press conference, so I'm gonna rely on you for that. But first, let me introduce you. I'm Robert Wright of Blogging Heads TV. You are Bob Cohen. Right now, laudably, you are teaching high school in a low-income school district, but you have spent most of your career as a journalist, and much of that as a golf journalist. You have covered Tiger Woods, and you are also the author of the book Why Golf, which I can commend to people, having read. And you are the co-author with Bob Rutella, who is an actual psychologist for a number of noted PGA players, a golf psychologist. You're the co-author of the bestseller Golf Is Not a Game of Perfect. I can attest, having tried to play golf, that it is not a game of perfect. And having played with you a few times many years ago, I can attest that you are closer to perfect than I am. Did I miss any salient facts about you in that introduction, Bob?
You overpraised my golf game by a significant degree, but I'll accept it with gratitude.
I was hearing it relative to mine, but it is actually a fact, I believe, that on no less a course than Congressional, where I think U.S. Opens have been played, you have shot in the 70s. Is that not true?
One fortunate afternoon, yes.
And as it happened, you encountered in the locker room a former U.S. Open champion, and you could brag to him about your score. Is that not true?
That's not quite right. I encountered him at the club across the road a bit from Congressional, Burning Tree, and it's a little bit of a politically incorrect statement to say that you actually played Burning Tree. But yes, Ken Venturi was there on a day that I happened to shoot a very good round, and he saw me in the locker room, and I had interviewed him once, and he said, "Well, how'd you play, Bob?" And I said, "Oh, not too bad, 76. And that was probably the highlight of my golfing career as I look back on it.
Yeah, well, mine hasn't had a highlight yet. You've seen some of the lowlights. What happened at this press conference? I was driving along IH-95 and missed it.
Well, not much, really. I was struck by a couple of things. First, Tiger pretty much continued to parrot the party line that he's been parroting for the last few exposures he's given to the media.
Mm-hmm.
And secondly, he did come out with more detail about the treatment that he got from Dr. Anthony Galea, who gave him, he said, plasma replacement therapy when he was trying to recover from a knee operation in 2008 and 2009.
Right, and that therapy is legitimate, but what has aroused suspicion is that this very doctor got busted when an assistant of his was trying to sneak human growth hormone, a performance-enhancing substance, across the Canadian border into the U.S., where he sees such patients as Tiger Woods, right?
Yeah, and Tiger simply said, "I've never used an illegal drug." And pretty much the reporters took him at his word, which surprised me. I thought somebody would say, "Tiger, you've lied about a lot of things, and why should we take your word for it?" And mm-hmm. "Would you please release your medical records?" And nobody said that, which is consistent with the other thing that I noticed, where Tiger professed to be friends with a lot of the reporters in the room, none of whom I suspect have his cell phone number, and to none of whom did he return any calls during the period in December, January, and February when their professional lives were being humiliated by the fact that they knew nothing about Tiger's affairs and could get no comment from him about the things that were going on in tabloids and gossip websites.
Mm-hmm. You think it was a pretty short and selective guest list as far as reporters who were allowed?
I think that the guest list was restricted to the golfing press, one writer per outlet, and I don't think the Masters was accepting mm-hmm. applications from Fleet Street tabloids or TMZ.com.
Yeah. And you, having covered Tiger and spoken with him and interviewed him, can probably attest to the fact that for someone who's going to continue to cover him as a golf journalist, There's not a really strong incentive to antagonize him by embarrassing him at a press conference, right?
Exactly. I think that that's one of the reasons why none of his off-course escapades got into the press until the gossip websites and so forth decided to take him on. Because golf journalists really need to stay on Tiger's good side. He doesn't give them a lot, but he gives them just enough to make it worth their while to suck up to him and not to offend him. And they do, for the most part.
And you were one of the people sucking up to him then for a while?
Yeah. As a matter of fact, I did. Like a delivery boy waiting for a big man, I would wait around the 18th green when I was a golf writer, and on practice days when Tiger might be available, and you needed a few quotes from Tiger that he wasn't likely to give out during a press conference, or you had to ask an extended series of questions, and you kind of plucked on his sleeve as he came off the course and hoped that he was in a good mood and would stop to answer a few questions. Or on one occasion, I remember he actually said, "Well, come on into the locker room." So I and a couple of other reporters went into the locker room and had a very pleasant 30-minute conversation about a wide range of things. And I got my questions in, and my editors were happy, and that was the way the game was played.
And what was your big question? What did you want to know?
I was working on a feature article, actually, about Johnny Miller, the television commentator, and one of the angles I wanted to cover was whether Woods was in agreement with or offended by the way that Miller would purport to know what was going on in Tiger's head as Tiger played. Mm-hmm. This happened to have been inspired by the 2004 U.S. Open when Tiger was not playing his best and Miller was saying, "Well, the wind has gotten inside Tiger's head." And the idea that I had was to ask Tiger, "Does Johnny Miller have any special insights into what's going on in your mind while you're out on the golf course?" And Tiger said, "No, he doesn't." So I was able to put that into the story, make it a much better story, as a matter of fact.
Well, Go ahead.
And so, you know, the opportunity to get that kind of question to Tiger and get a reasonable answer from him is very valuable to golf writers.
Yeah, I was just going to say parenthetically, Johnny Miller's pet theory as an analyst, and he's a great and colorful analyst and a smart guy and a formerly great golfer, but his pet theory about almost every golfer who has trouble is that they're having head trouble. Often they're choking and so on. That's his favorite explanation. It's just funny because, as you know, he kind of famously must have had some sort of head trouble because he had tremendous promise as a young golfer and then his career kind of collapsed.
Yeah, and he got the putting. He lost confidence in his putting stroke and got very wristy and jabby with his putting. And that's why he basically got out of competitive golf. And to this day, he will look at a putt on the green and say, "Oh, this is a green light putt." And that raises the question, well, what would be a red light putt, John? What would you try to do on a red light putt? Miss it?
Right.
And
right.
The answer would be, well, for Johnny Miller, certain putts were so frightening that he didn't worry about trying to make it. He just tried to make sure the ball didn't go more than 4 or 5 feet past the hole.
Yeah. But he's a great commentator. So did you suggest earlier that you think there were some golf journalists who knew about Tiger's escapades? I think you've said in the past that you did not, but do you think some did?
I certainly had no idea, and I don't think that any of the golf writers knew because they wouldn't try to find out anything about what's going on once Tiger leaves the golf course, or they rarely would. And certainly they wouldn't poke around into that part of his life because there would be no percentage in it for them. If they were to uncover something, it would be highly uncomfortable for them to write about it. And it's not something that you really think of yourself as doing when you become a golf writer. You want to write about the game. You don't really want to write about somebody's philandering. Mm-hmm. So I don't think any of the journalists knew about it. I think that they probably were highly unlikely to ever find out about it, given the way that golf journalism works.
Mm-hmm. So he does seem to have kept it to a small circle, although not as small as he claims, probably, according to some tell. He claims nobody knew. There is evidence that his agent knew and so on. But
yeah,
anyway.
He's backtracked on that a little bit in the last few days. and said that, they didn't know everything or something like that. But I think that there were several enablers in his entourage, including his agent and a boyhood buddy named Brian Bell, who's now the president of Tiger Woods Golf Design. Mm-hmm. And who bought apparently some tickets for some of the girlfriends when they would fly to distant locales to visit him.
Yeah. Or maybe he thought they were needy youth who were being helped by the Tiger Woods Foundation or something.
Could be.
So Tiger psychology is a big question here. I mean, both in terms of, was there something about his psychology that made him think he could get away with this forever, and in the sense of, can he withstand the new kind of pressure that's going to be on him now? Although, of course, we should say that one virtue of the Masters from his point of view is it's at Augusta National, which is probably the golf course where he's least likely to be heckled. And heckling in general is not something you hear much on a golf course, and people will be ejected for it. I'm pretty much in any PGA event, but what just
Augusta National is I once had the thought that if Adolf Hitler had a country club, it would be Augusta National because it is run on highly dictatorial lines. If you exceed a sedate walk as a spectator trying to move from one part of the course to another, you're chastened by Pinkerton guards almost instantly.
Yeah.
And the grass is tended to a frightening degree. But it's a beautiful place in many respects, yeah. And it's a temple to a lot of the values that golf holds dear, including exclusivity and misogyny. But nevertheless, it's a place
Are there still no female members of Augusta?
Still no female members of Augusta.
Uh-huh.
But it's a place where, yeah, you would be afraid that you would lose your ticket if you misbehaved.
Your season privileges, right? I mean,
your lifetime privileges.
Right.
They have such
You'd
a waiting
list.
You'd never
be set foot in the course again if you heckled Tiger.
Yes, probably right.
So, yeah, there is an authoritarian era. They used to control the media. They would control the advertising. You know, they were so image conscious that CBS was only allowed to have, like, certain kinds of, I think, Cadillac ads. Of course, that was before Tiger drove his Cadillac into a tree. I don't know how that's influenced things. But and I think they've loosened up a little. They used to permit no or little coverage in the first two rounds. So, in fact, is the first round going to be televised live from hole one?
There will not be live coverage of the entire round, certainly not of Tiger's round. There will be several hours of ESPN coverage, and I'm sure we'll see a good deal of what Tiger does during the course of the day.
I would like to be watching live at the moment, you know. But
you'll see his first tee shot. They have said that. After that, they haven't guaranteed anything.
So what about his psychology? First, let's start at the beginning. What about his – golf's a total head game, or largely a head game. What do you think of, what is it about his psychology that has helped him dominate the game so?
Well, I think that you would have to say that Tiger has almost a preternatural confidence that's been developed by a lot of success, but also by the way his father taught him to think. One little insight, I remember that day in Los Angeles when I chatted with him in the locker room, and he had just recently been married, and he was talking about the day when he would become a father, and how he looked forward to the possibility of having a son and hoped that the son would like to play golf, because if the son did like to play golf, then he would also look forward to the day when the son joined him on the PGA Tour. And I wanted to say, Tiger, do you realize what the odds are against any kid who wants to play golf becoming a PGA Tour player, regardless of whether he's the son of a professional or not? But I realized that the odds that I considered to be astronomical for Tiger were inconsequential. He just figured that if his son wanted to become a PGA Tour professional, he would.
Yeah.
And Tiger thinks that if he decides he wants to win a tournament, he very likely will win it.
Go ahead.
I admire that. Yeah, I mean, that's one of the reasons he is who he is and why he is as good as he is.
But I've wondered whether, I mean, what you've described comes pretty close to a sense of entitlement. And I've wondered whether that psychology is related to how he got into this scandal and how it deepened, a sense that everything's going to work out. You know, that's the kind of confidence he has on the golf course. Things will work out. And I wonder if he ever gave serious thought to the possibility that he might get caught or that he in any sense didn't deserve it.
Well, certainly not serious enough, I guess he would say now. But I think that probably, you know, you're exactly right. And he has mentioned he had a sense of entitlement. And I think that that contributed to his ultimate folly, that he thought he could get away with whatever he wanted to get away with, and that he would not suffer the consequences that most people would consider to be highly likely if they were to engage in the same kind of activity.
Mm-hmm. And I mean, confidence just is so much a part of the psychology of golf. People don't. One thing people don't understand about golf is that they think that it should be easy because the ball isn't moving like in baseball, you know. But that's the hard part. Because you're not reacting reflexively to something, you have time to think. You know, you don't have to start your backswing at any given time. So you're thinking about it, and that's where the trouble starts, I find. Mm-hmm. And that's why just confidence is so important. I suppose there's such a thing as overconfidence in golf. Well, yeah, Phil Mickelson is known to be not sufficiently risk averse, but the confidence is just so you think that is the biggest element in his psychology in terms of accounting for his success?
I think it is. The toughness of mind, the focus, the belief that when he is under pressure, he will produce his best golf. It stands him in good stead in an enormous number of situations in tournament golf. Maybe didn't stand him in such good stead when he was in Las Vegas with his friends Michael Jordan and Charles Barkley, and the first cocktail waitress sat down in his lap.
Yeah. Although a certain part of that confidence, I'm sure, was shown to be warranted that very evening. But yeah, the larger version of it wasn't. So what is this? I mean, do you think is that same part of the psychology the thing that's going to keep him from collapsing under the weight of all of this? Or do you think he will?
Yeah, I had the impression at the press conference watching it today on television that, yeah, the essence of Tiger has not changed.
Right.
He is still very cool, very calculating, very confident. And, yes, he's fallen, and yes, he's been humiliated, and yes, he probably regrets for a variety of reasons the things that he did, but I don't think that that really affects the fact that he still considers himself to be the man as far as golf is concerned.
Mm-hmm. So you think he's basically going to go out there and play pretty well?
Yeah, I would be surprised if he didn't make the cut. I would also be surprised if he won the golf tournament, because he has taken 5.5 months off, mm-hmm. and he has not played enough tournament golf to be sharp. And that's very important at a course like Augusta, which requires tremendous precision, particularly around the greens, in order to succeed. And mm-hmm. without that kind of precision, without that kind of honed game, even Tiger is not likely to win. And even in the best of circumstances, Tiger won, you know, 4 Masters out of 15 tries. So
yeah,
his chances of winning were never better than 1 in 3 or 1 in 4. And now I would say probably no better than 1 in 10.
Right. No, it's never the case that any single golfer has a better than 50% chance going into a tournament of winning. I mean, so far as we can tell going in, because there's so many good players, not even Tiger Woods. So, do you have any doubt that he will go on to break Nicklaus's record of 18 majors? And we should say, for those who aren't golfers, that is more than anything, I think, is driving obsession. I mean, that is taken as the standard of whether you're the greatest ever. There are 4 majors per year, kind of like tennis. Augusta is one of them. The Masters is one of them. And he's won 14. Nicklaus has won 18 and has not won 14 at Tiger's age, I believe. So do you think, is there serious doubt in your mind that he will ultimately eclipse Nicklaus?
Yeah, I would say that it's not a sure thing. Mm-hmm. He mentioned at his press conference today, you know, that he's had 4 knee surgeries on his left knee. And he talked also about how he had tears in his Achilles tendon on his right leg during the last year or so. So yeah, he puts a tremendous amount of stress on his body when he swings a golf club the way he does. And it's not clear that his health will hold up, that physically he might not be able to stay in golf long enough to surpass Nicklaus's record. In addition to that, there are new golfers coming along who might be as good as Tiger was when he was younger.
Yeah.
And all of those factors lead me to say that I think he will catch Nicklaus. I'll be a little surprised if he doesn't, but it's by no means a sure thing.
Well, this scandal is the first thing that led me to entertain doubt that he would. Although, one thing that's come up during the scandal is not just a scandal per se that changed my mind, but the coverage of the scandal made it something clear that wasn't clear before, which is that his knee has still been bothering him. And, you know, gets back to this doctor who's been treating him. He's been, I think, in some discomfort even after the layoff and the knee surgery. His knee's not 100%. And to get back to his psychology, kind of, haven't you always thought, I mean, one reason that people think his knee is in trouble is because he swings so hard and puts so much pressure on that knee every time he swings. Haven't you always thought he swung harder than he really needed to and, in fact, might have been as good or better if he had swung less hard? Is that a crazy thought?
I don't think it's a crazy thought at all. I think back to the British Open that he won the year after his father died, when he used an iron off the tee on all but one of the 72 holes, and he gave up the distance in order to be in the fairway and keep his ball under control, and he won that tournament rather easily.
Mm-hmm.
So he could probably give up some distance off the tee in favor of precision and rely on his iron game and his putting and his chipping and his pitching, all of which are superb, and his mental focus, which is the best that I think golf has ever seen, and do quite well. In fact, maybe do a little better than he has. But I think Tiger enjoys hitting it a long way. Most people do.
Right, but this gets back to the question of whether he's actually, his head has gotten, aspects of his personality maybe have gotten in the way of his game before this scandal became the first clear example of that. In other words, look, like a lot of great athletes, the guy's got an ego. And you're right, a lot of people like to hit it as far as possible. I'm not sure that Jack Nicklaus would have ever let that desire get in the way of hitting what he, you know, thought was the ideal club with the ideal tempo swing. But another example is, you know, famously, I mean, one thing about Tiger is that as great as his record is, he has kind of failed to achieve what you would have extrapolated out when he was in his mid-20s, right? He had just done stunning, amazing things. He hasn't really kept up that pace. And one thing that arguably got in the way was he seems to have fired his swing coach, who had led him to such success, Butch Harmon, apparently because he was getting jealous of the amount of attention Butch Harmon was getting, right? Isn't that the story you've heard?
I've heard that, and I believe it's probably true. Butch Harmon developed an unfortunate habit, as far as Tiger was concerned, of saying "we" when he was referring to Tiger's success.
Right.
And Tiger didn't like that. Tiger didn't like it when Fluff Cowan, his original tour caddy, started appearing in advertisements and becoming a little bit of a celebrity himself. And Tiger got rid of Butch Harmon. Tiger got rid of Mike Cowan. And in both cases, he hired people who were and are very tight-lipped about Tiger and about themselves with the press.
But after he fired Butch Harmon, he did go into a slump, right? A sustained slump.
Yes, but I think that also had something to do with the fact that Tiger practices a lot, and I think that he has to face the problem of being a little bit bored with what he's practicing. If he keeps hitting 300-yard drives down the middle, how many can he hit before he gets bored? And so I think he has sometimes invented things that he wants to fix. And
right.
He's retooled his swing a couple of times, ostensibly because he wants to improve his chances of winning. But I think in part because part of the satisfaction of golf is working on your game and improving it. And if your game is as good as it can get, you would tend to lose that. So he's broken his swing down and rebuilt it periodically, and I think the reason is he likes that sense of improvement, of self, of forcing himself to do things a little better, a little differently, and so on. And I think that's part of the satisfaction that he gets, part of the reason that he has such a renowned work ethic is because he enjoys that aspect of golf.
Yeah, well, that's all true, and I know he did rebuild his swing after he fired Harmon, but it just seems to me to let you know, some sort of jealousy of his coach or his caddy, as if, you know, golf fans decades from now would be saying, yeah, the greatest golfing phenomenon ever was Tiger Woods and Butch Harmon. I mean, come on, there's no danger of that, Tiger. Relax. We all know who's actually swinging the golf club. That just seems to me, if you've got, you know, a combination that's working for you the way Butch Harmon was working for him, you know, I just think that's really a form of hubris to let go of him on grounds that just strike me as kind of petty.
Well, one of the things that's part of Tiger's personality, one of the probably least attractive parts of it, is that he is very sensitive to the possibility that someone will make some money using him or his image, and he won't get a cut or won't get the proper credit or whatever. You know, his agents have made trouble for painters who took photographs made of Tiger during tournaments and created paintings and tried to sell them. I remember once at a tournament in Southern California, he was walking into the practice area, and a marshal, an older man, volunteer at the tournament, had been waiting all day for this moment, and he pushed forward a book that somebody else had written about Tiger, an unauthorized biography. And Tiger should have, maybe today he would have, stopped and signed it anyway, because the man was a volunteer at the tournament. But instead, he just kind of coldly looked at the man, brushed past him, and said, I won't sign that. It's not authorized.
Now that is,
and that, to me, was petty, and I think it's part of Tiger's personality that's probably less attractive than some other parts.
Yeah. I have to confess, I kind of fell in love with I totally fell for Tiger. I wrote a column in Slate near the very beginning in the late 90s of his career. I kind of bought his dad's line that he was the chosen one and could do great things with the work for the world, you know. Like, he struck me as the kind of guy who might, after his career, actually use his reputation for the good, and the fact that he's multi-ethnic and the fact that he's a global hero might actually do some good. But then I just, in watching him on the course, I became steadily more disenchanted with him. And among the reasons are the ones you cited, and the tempered tantrums. I mean, of course, by definition, those are things that are not easy to control. But, you know, and even, and I'm kind of old school in terms of self-celebration. Like, I don't like end zone dances. I grew up when a player in the major leagues, when he hit a home run, he didn't even pause to admire his work because that was considered a sign of disrespect for the pitcher, you know. And if he did take too long running around the bases and seemed to revel in it, the pitcher would throw at his head the next time. Those were the rules. And, I'm a big fan of humility on the course, and Tiger took a sport where traditionally that's been really valued, and I would say, you know, diluted that tradition a little with the now famous kind of fist pumps. I mean, there have always been circumstances under which any golfer would get excited. It's just that Tiger kind of lowered the threshold on that.
Maybe a tiny bit, but, you know, I think back. You remember when Hale Irwin won the United States Open out of Medina?
That's a famous piece of footage, him doing a lap around the green.
And he ran a lap and slapped hands with the crowd. And, you know, there's a picture of Arnold Palmer from the 1960 U.S. Open throwing his visor into the crowd at the end of his round.
Yeah.
There's a picture of Nicklaus on the 17th green at Augusta back in 1986 with his putter raised over his head, walking toward the hole as he watched the putt head toward the hole. And triumphant, and in fact, Nicklaus uses the logo made from that image at his club in North Palm Beach, Florida. So I think that within limits, there's always been a tradition allowing players in critical situations with big achievements to show some emotion, and I don't think Tiger has transgressed in that area. I do think he has been guilty of the occasional tossing of clubs and uttering of oaths, which are things that I do myself on the golf course, so I can't get too wrapped up about it. But I do know
clubs?
That it's against the code of conduct for
professional
golfers.
Do you actually throw clubs, Bob? Do you throw clubs?
I let them fall rather heavily to the ground, let's say that.
You know, I hold the record there. When I was 18, I threw a club so far I lost it. I never found that club. It was a pitching wedge.
You know, I remember once playing around with terrible Tommy Bolt back in the day when he was already retired. And he was a sweet old man, and suddenly on the eighth hole, he hit a little fat 8-iron, and the club went whoosh, 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 out in front. And I said, I bet you just did that so I know that you still had it. And he said, yep. And he said, I also wanted to pass along a tip. I said, what's that? He said, always throw the club out ahead of you because it's a lot easier to pick it up that way.
That's what I should have done. Tiger's gotten a certain amount of heat for this, including from Arnold Palmer, for, like, you know, driving clubs into the ground, you know, as just, you know, failing to maintain the character of the game. And now, has he explicitly vowed that he will reform in that area now in the wake of this?
He said today that he's going to try to play on a more even emotional keel, which will preclude both the temper tantrums and the fist pumps. But he didn't make any promises in that regard, and I think it remains to be seen once he gets into the heat of competition how even his emotional keel will be.
Mm-hmm. Well, he can regain my favor. I doubt that's at the top of his list of must-do items, regaining my favor, but he could regain my favor if he did a little of that, I would say. Is there anything else you want to say about his psychology before we kind of move on to the kind of a moral question surrounding all this?
No, I just think it's going to be extremely interesting. And to be honest, I think I'm probably a little more inclined to root for Tiger now because he has a heavy burden to carry. I've always felt in the past that it was a little too easy for him, and I've tended to root for people like Rocco Mediate, who seemed much closer to the kind of golfer that I am than for Tiger. But now Tiger's got some problems that I can identify with, if not for the specific causes, then certainly for the tendency to be distracted.
Yeah, the other thing Rocco Mediate had going for him in that famous U.S. Open finish was that he had a big peace sign on his belt buckle, which I thought was, especially in the PGA, was just so radically left-wing, you know, that he won my heart right there. And, you know, I just want to pause and visit that moment a little. This is the last major that Tiger won. It was in, I guess, 2008. It was the U.S. Open. That was to get him his due, that was an accomplishment of mythic proportions, if you ask me. Because as I understand it, he knew going into that thing that his knee was in pretty serious trouble. But the U.S. Open, of course, is played at a different course every year. And this was his opportunity to win it on the course that had probably the most emotional significance to him of any. And the reason is that it was the course that his father had taken him to when he was a young kid. And his father finally said, look, you ready for a real golf course? And he took him to, I guess it was Torrey Pines, right? This is the story, at least. And that supposedly is why Tiger was so determined to win a U.S. Open there. He went out and was limping, you know, at times, was grimacing in pain. And the comeback, the match itself, the fourth round, was amazing, including, a 12 or 14 foot putt to tie it and then carry it into, OT the next day. So I've said a lot of negative things about him. That was, to my mind, I remember saying at the time, if he has ruined his knee and so he never matches Nicklaus's record, this is such a mythic accomplishment that it may be better for his legacy than not doing this and winning the 19 majors, you know. But anyway, I don't know if you share my view of how amazing that was, but
yes, amazing, and you have to hand it to him. I mean, I think that without any question, he is the best golfer of all time. He's not the one with the most career majors, but that record has a lot to do with longevity as well as brilliance. And it's a valuable record from that point of view, but nobody, not Jack Nicklaus, not Bobby Jones, nobody matched what Tiger did at his peak when he won four professional majors in a row and held those titles simultaneously.
And he probably does.
Or the one that you mentioned, the Open where he had a broken leg.
Although Ben Hogan coming back after the car accident has some things in common with that to win the U.S. Open. But the what was I going to say?
The moral question.
You mentioned that you're rooting. You know, I wrote a piece, Times Online piece about Tiger Woods and got a fair amount of heat for it. I didn't say we should root for him to fail. I did raise the possibility. I said, you know, I think it's an important question what happens to him now and how this plays out, because the guy is a role model to a lot of kids, and if the moral of the story is, hey, you can do this and rampantly cheat on your wife, in a particularly, in my mind, to my mind, unglamorous fashion, and then just pick up where you left off, you know, go to rehab, come back, not miss a single major tournament, proceed from there, and you don't look to be any the worse for it. I said, you know, that may not be a great message that to be sent to kids, so it might be that it's better if his career never gets on track. I didn't endorse that scenario myself. I raised the prospect. But anyway, I think you took issue with the column.
Well, I did. I thought that, first of all, in terms of assuring that our children have chaste role models in public life, I think that horse has long since left the barn. The kids have no shortage of heroes who have shown that their private lives are hardly impeccable, beginning with Bill Clinton and going through any number of professional athletes and celebrities of various kinds who have been caught in situations that you wouldn't want your child to find himself in. So I don't think that it's necessarily reasonable to think that Tiger alone should bear that burden. When Kobe Bryant didn't bear that burden, when any number of rock stars with bastard children all over the landscape don't bear that burden, and when, you know, Bill Clinton is not really a pariah, or any of the other presidents before him who were caught with somebody they shouldn't have been caught with, at least by history, or, say, Martin Luther King, who was caught and went on to make a tremendous contribution.
Although he was caught in a media environment in which it didn't become known to everyone, right?
Well, I think that it was probably pretty well known in Washington because Hoover had the information.
Yeah.
And Hoover let it be known to certain people. But again, in that media environment, you just didn't write that sort of thing the way it would be written now. It's
right,
an interesting question. Could Martin Luther King have accomplished what he accomplished if he were operating in the media environment of 2010? I'd say quite likely not.
Right. It is an interesting question. Of course, you could turn it around and say, look, you know, okay, a lot of famous men cheat, so what we're saying is incumbent upon them is not to not cheat per se, but at least to do it in a way that you don't get caught. And because that's when you do the damage, if you buy my premise that you're doing damage to the extent that it's publicized and you're perceived as getting away with it. So you could say that, Martin Luther King operated within the rules of the game at his time. He didn't get caught. And now, of course, it's harder to not get caught. We live in this age of transparency, and maybe that's what you could say was what Tiger was obligated to do and failed to do, is to at least do this in a way that would, you know, remain behind closed doors.
Well, I'm sure that Tiger wishes he had. But I don't think that it changes the fact that other people have sinned and have gone on to be permitted in one way or another to accomplish what they were going to accomplish within their chosen field. And so I'm prepared to give Tiger the same latitude that Thomas Jefferson gets, or that FDR got, or that John Kennedy got. Yeah. And to say, well, his private life is not admirable, but that doesn't change my evaluation of his professional contribution.
Mm-hmm. You know, Thomas Jefferson certainly had an easier media environment, I guess, although, I don't know, in those days, the newspapers used to, I think, publicize some pretty scandalous allegations.
Yes, they did. They wrote about it and cast aspersions, and Jefferson just kind of wrote it out, which I think is what Tiger is going to wind up doing.
And are you of the view that this stuff in general does not hurt an athlete's performance?
You know, if it does, I haven't seen any evidence of it. And obviously nobody's going to assemble a scientific study of athletes who cheat and athletes who don't and whether they succeed in their sport. But certainly golf, for example, has no shortage of examples of players who were philanderers off the golf course and quite successful on it. One of the records that Tiger is chasing is the record for the total number of PGA Tour events won. It's a record that is a little bit fuzzy because in Sam Snead's day, there were some events that may or may not have been regular tour events, but somewhere in the mid-80s is where Snead's record is, and Tiger has 71 victories. Snead was famous for his philandering, and famous now, I guess, openly famous, and back in his own heyday, it was an open secret that nobody wrote about, but everybody knew about, that Snead carried on with women, and it didn't seem to change his performance on the golf course, and I don't know that there's any reason to think that it will change Tiger's performance.
Yeah. It's a tough question because so often the philandering is correlated with other behaviors like drinking heavily that might be more destructive of athletic performance. I mean, if you compare a Willie Mays and a Mickey Mantle, Mickey Mantle was a kind of a famous philanderer and a famous drinker. And I think there's no doubt that the fact that Willie Mays led a more disciplined lifestyle is partly explains why Willie Mays has better career stats, hit, I don't know, more than 100 more home runs than Mickey Mantle, although their native talent was probably comparable. Mantle also had some injury, a knee issue, but it's hard to say whether it's the philandering or the drinking. And, you know, Mickey Mantle, according to Jim Bowden's book, Bowl 4, showed up for games either actually drunk or so heavily hungover that, you know, it was a challenge to pick up the bat. Now in Tiger's case, the only drug I've heard about in conjunction with this is Ambien, which he used not only to sleep, but by some accounts it was part of the preamble to some of the sex. Apparently there's something, this Ambien abetted sex, according to this, is actually something that, you know, that he found gratifying.
Well, you're getting it beyond my area of expertise here.
Oh, come on, Bob.
He's also admitted to Vicodin, which is a painkiller.
Yeah, but
I think that was in conjunction with his recovery from surgery.
Right. He hasn't copped to doing that recreationally. We don't know that he has. But I certainly haven't heard anything about a whole lot of drinking.
No, and I think Tiger is, from what I've heard, and I had one conversation with him about weight and how he tries to maintain his weight and what he tries to eat. He's very conscious of diet. He's very conscious of fitness. I don't know for sure that he drinks or doesn't drink, but I would be surprised if he would allow anything like that to affect his performance. Mm-hmm. He's extremely disciplined physically.
Although I would say that, I mean, as I said earlier, he's one of the few golfers whose ability seems not to have grown over time between early 20s and mid-30s. Normally, this is a golfer's prime, where he is right now. And I know there have been injuries and so on, but when he was in his early to mid-20s, I mean, first of all, he won the Masters by 12 in 97 or something, and then the incredible, you know, four majors in a row. There were times when he was so much more dominant than any golfer had ever been, and yet he was nowhere near what is traditionally your prime as a golfer, which is to say your early 30s, mid-30s. And I kind of wonder whether really many years ago he didn't start getting a little distracted by this.
It's quite possible that he could have played better during the time that he was carrying on if he had been, as he said today at his press conference, at peace with himself. Mm-hmm. But I think it's also conceivable that he is such a prodigy and started at such a young age that, like Mozart or Orson Welles, you don't judge him by the normal chronological standards that people are judged by. In other words, right, his prime may well have been when he was 22 or 3, and it was such a high prime that it would be unreasonable to expect him to continue to get better from that stage.
And he did spur, one reason his relative dominance waned is he did spur others to train more aggressively and so on.
Yes.
And I kind of suspect that during this period, performance-enhancing drugs have actually entered golf in a significant way. I don't know if you agree.
I don't know if it's true or not. I certainly have learned that you can't take anything on faith when it comes to performance-enhancing drugs.
Yeah.
And I've seen some players out there who look to me to be very ripped, and that's usually been a sign in other sports that somebody's using something illegal.
Ripped in the sense of their physical, their muscle tone, and their physiques.
Yeah, exactly. And little guys who have bulging muscles and hit the ball a ton.
And Tiger Woods is one of these guys who's developed in this regard, right?
Yes, he is. So I don't take it. I don't take his word for the fact that he hasn't been using them. I think that the only way to know for sure would be if he submitted to voluntary random testing at an intense level, and I don't think that there's any likelihood that the PGA Tour is going to subject him or anybody else on the tour to that. They really don't want a scandal, and they would have one if they caught a championship-caliber player having used those things.
And then there are things like beta blockers, which make you resistant to pressure, right? And are those even illegal in the PGA?
I believe they are illegal. I don't know that the efficacy of beta blockers, they're supposedly something that might help you with your putting or something like that, because
that could matter.
They calm your nerves under stress.
Right.
But I don't know that there's been any evidence that they really work that well. But they are illegal, yes.
And is human growth hormone, which this doctor who treated Tiger for something else that, with his knee, has been connected with, is that, do you know if that's illegal in the PGA?
It's illegal in the United States in general, and it's also illegal on the PGA Tour.
To do it without a prescription in the United States is illegal.
Yeah.
So it would have been illegal if nothing else. And is that thought to be, I think that is a true miracle drug, right? I mean, that would make me like a better golfer or something, right? I mean,
it might make you a stronger golfer, but the correlation between strength and golf ability is not a particularly strong one. If you look at the celebrity tournaments where football players who play various positions play golf,
yeah,
the best golfers are frequently the place kickers, because they are kind of limber and they have mm-hmm. good flexibility and coordination. The quarterbacks also tend to be
well.
Great,
I mean, also place kickers.
The really strong players, the linebackers and the tackles, they can't play golf at all.
Although I'd add that place kicking faces very much the psychological challenge of golf play. I mean, if you're a good place kicker, you've got the head game under control, I would say, you know.
Yes, that's true. There are some elements in common.
Okay, so I just kind of, in closing, I wanted to get your talk a little bit about the in this context, to some extent, the really admirable turn your career has taken. I mean, I mentioned earlier the idea of role models. Well, you are teaching some kids for whom I would say role models of some sort matter in some way, right? You're teaching in one of the lower income areas, I gather, Prince George County.
Prince George's County, yeah.
Prince George's County, which has a lot of middle-class black neighborhoods, PG County, but you're not teaching in one of those, right?
No, I'm teaching in a neighborhood just over the line from the District of Columbia. It's a kind of a blue-collar suburb that was erected in mostly the post-World War II era. It was a white neighborhood for about 20 years, and it flipped over into being a black neighborhood shortly after the riots in 1968, and now it's the school that I teach in is 92% African American and 7 or 8% Hispanic, and we have practically no white students, and our income level is pretty low. I think even worse than the income level is the sort of family situations that my kids come from. I have very few kids who live with both their biological parents. Most of them come from a separated family of one kind or another. Some of them have never met their fathers. Some of them are living with step-parents or grandparents. And that is a contributing factor in the academic problems that we face at Central High School.
Yeah.
Central High is one of those schools for which the No Child Left Behind Act was intended.
Yeah, well, this gets back to my kind of concern about the way the Tiger thing is treated. I mean, as you agree that coming from a household without a father, is a liability as you head into life and get your education and so on. So it does seem to me that it matters whether or not when you see something like what Tiger did, which is, you know, not just cheat on his wife, okay, and not just cheat rampantly on his wife, but cheat with a kind of category of women that sends the signal that, look, women are just sex objects. They're there to have sex with, right? I mean, not much evidence that he was feeling very affectionately toward any but possibly one of these women. They were topless dancers, allegedly, porn stars, and so on. And, of course, you know, in these low-income black areas, this idea that women are just sex objects and they're not there for you to, like, build a family with is already being reinforced by the music and so on and by God knows how many role models. Now, it may not be that, that Tiger Woods is really one of the most important role models in this particular demographic, but so you can probably speak to that, whether he is, and if not, who is.
Well, I think that there are a number of factors, many of which have nothing to do with role models. You know, the employment prospects for black males and historical trends and so forth,
right,
that are much more significant contributors to the problem of disintegration in black families. And nor is that problem confined to black families. I think it's something that affects families of all colors. Wealthier white families probably are able to cope with it a little better than families already living on the margins. But putting that aside, I don't think anybody would argue that what Tiger has done is helpful. On the other hand, I think it would be a mistake to overemphasize or to overestimate the extent to which Tiger is, in fact, relevant to any of the kids at Central High School. None of them play golf. None of them talk about Tiger Woods. They're very interested in who is in the NBA and who is in the NFL. They know a lot about the lives of rap stars, and God knows they're not particularly good role models in most cases. But golf is a country club sport. Tiger is a mixed-race kid who has $1 billion and lives in a world that is in no way related to the world that these kids grow up in. And I don't see any evidence that he's a particularly influential role model. I think we tend to overestimate the degree to which race makes somebody a role model as opposed to the sort of social circumstances and style and other things that kids pick up on. I think I may have mentioned to you the surprise that I got just this year when I try to get my 10th grade English class to read Barack Obama's autobiography, and they hated it, partly because I think the vocabulary was a little more sophisticated than they were prepared to deal with, but also because they couldn't identify with a middle-class striver, even if his skin was more or less the color that theirs is. On the other hand, I tried getting them to read a book called The Outsiders by S.E. Hinton, which is a story of some Oklahoma rednecks, and they loved that book because they could identify with the idea of kids who were from the wrong side of the tracks, kids who had to stay in gangs to be safe, and kids who had to fight for their honor and live by a code that wasn't particularly affected by the law and the rules. And they liked that book. So I don't think that just because Tiger is partly African-American means that he's a particularly significant role model for kids at a school like Central High.
Right. Okay. There are role models who matter, but they're by and large in that particular demographic, not him.
Yeah, and in their own homes and their own communities. I think it would be tremendous if there were more examples of, you know, successful black males who stuck with their families in their communities. But unfortunately, when someone from Central High's community becomes successful and has a stable family, he's generally going to move out.
To a different part of PG County.
Or someplace else.
Yeah. Okay. Well, my daughter's about to show up any moment. It's now the appointed hour, and we, in any event, are at the approaching the limit of our,
time. She makes you stay in the car while she tours?
She was certainly willing for that to be the case.
My daughter made me do that once at Columbia. She said, "Dad, I don't want you walking around with me. You ask all kinds of stupid questions."
You know, Eleanor is surprisingly open to my being an embarrassment. I'm happy to say. I remember when I was a teenager, I didn't want people to know I had parents. You know, I didn't want to be seen with my parents. So I have to give her that. She's actually, at other campuses, I went on the tours and asked questions and so on, and she did not disown me. So I'm grateful for that.
Well, it's probably a testament to your being a good role model.
And a good golfer, I think, don't you?
I think you have tremendous potential. It's only a question of, do you want to be a scholar and a writer, or do you want to be a single-digit handicap?
Forced to choose. Well, I don't think I have the choice. Maybe there was a time when I did, but I think a single-digit handicap is out of reach. Well, thank you so much, and really thank you for the for this turn your career has taken. You really are doing God's work. And I guess you have to close this read your book Why Golf, which addresses the question that golfers themselves especially appreciate, which is, why do I keep subjecting myself to this torture? What is it that attracts people to the game? And your co-authored work with Bob Rotella, Golf is Not a Game of Perfect. But in closing, I think, it's traditional in situations like this to demand some sort of prediction. So what's going to happen in the Masters, Bob?
My prediction is that a European will win it. I'm not sure which European. Could be Padraig Harrington, could be Paul Casey, could be Ian Poulter, Lee Westwood. But I don't think this is going to be an American year at the Masters.
Okay, well, like Phil Mickelson himself, I'm going to go for the long ball here. I'm not going to do some vague, someone who lives on this continent will win it, you know. I mean, with all due respect, Bob. I'm going to be more specific and say that although Mickelson is not off to a good start, he didn't even play in last week's. Never count him out of the Masters, I say. So I'm predicting Mickelson finishes first, Tiger Woods finishes, let's say third. And Ernie Els second. Let's go for the trifecta.
All right. Well, then, if you put me to it, I would say Padraig Harrington, Paul Casey, and Ernie Els.
Harrington has a way of doing well at these things. I just wish he were a more interesting guy, you know?
He's a really nice guy.
That's what I'm saying.
Well, you know, and I think that there are some interesting aspects that he tends to be fairly modest about them. But, you know, he grew up in a sort of a blue-collar area of Dublin. His father was a cop.
Is that right?
He learned to play at a course that was constructed by police, and he didn't have a practice range. It was a kind of a very blue-collar little club, and so he learned chipping and putting early on, and he's always let that be the mainstay of his game, and he is a very hard worker and an extremely personable, very pleasant guy to be around. And I tend to root for guys like that, so that's why I'm picking him.
Tell me, who are the other, really good guys that you would only, on the tour, that only you would know this about because you've actually covered them?
Well, I tend to meet a lot of the Rotella clients.
Uh-huh.
And I would say that among the nicest guys out there, one who's now working for NBC, he's sort of retired from competitive golf, Brad Faxon.
Mm-hmm.
Nick Price is an awfully nice guy. He's now on the senior tour.
He's always struck me that way.
There are a lot of guys who are extremely pleasant, and as a reporter, you're very grateful for those guys because they're always willing to give you a few minutes and talk a bit, and you can fill out a story with quotes from them. And so when I watch a golf tournament as a fan, I'm rooting for them. And mm-hmm. Padraig is one that cooperated on one of the books that I did with Bob Rotella, and was extremely pleasant, extremely affable, and very insightful about his own game and the way he first almost blew and then won the British Open. Mm-hmm. And so I'm rooting for Padraig.
Well, now with what you've told me about his background, I'm a Padraig fan myself. I mean, that's Lee Trevino levels of upward social mobility. So I like that.
Well, the other thing you'd like about Padraig is that he got his education as an accountant. and not that you're fond of accountants necessarily,
big fan of
but
accountants.
He stayed an amateur golfer until he had his education as an accountant, and only after he had done that and won a few amateur tournaments did he figure that he had what it took to turn pro. He was not one of these guys that went to college on a golf scholarship and never expected to make his living any other way besides professional golf.
Hmm. Okay. Well, I'm a part of, you've totally converted me. I was putting him in the category of Mike Weir, who I just is the too boring to root for category, but you've converted me.
And besides which, he'd look great in a green jacket.
He would. He's never won the Masters?
Never has.
So he's won three majors, right, but no Masters?
Yeah, he's won two British Opens and a PGA, and I think he's been working on his game. He's another one of those guys that's kind of a tinkerer, and he's changed a few things, and he took a couple of steps backwards as a result. But the last few weeks, he's been coming along, and I think he's ready. And he's played well at Augusta in the past. He's been very close.
Okay.
So he knows how to play the golf course. And I think that if I had to pick one guy, certainly I'm picking partly with my heart. But I think Padraig has a good chance. And I think, as I said before, I was condemned for being too vague. I think this is going to be a European year.
Okay. Well, my daughter is approaching the car. So we will we'll close with that prediction. And thanks a million, Bob.
All right, Bob. Thank you.
Okay. See you around.
Bye-bye.